Well, what a wonderful passage. We're going to dive into it together. Let me tell you, the story gets even more exciting in weeks to come. So it ends on a kind of cliffhanger. Still no rain in the land. We'll have to wait next week until the thunderstorm. But you'll find in the inside of the service sheet a little outline, which I hope will be a help to you as we go through all there is in this passage. And we begin with just a little summary of King Ahab. Well, if you were here last week, you know there was a whole series of summaries of a whole series of kings. Rehoboam, Abijam, Asa, Nadab, Baasha, Elah, Zimri, Omri. And they were pretty much all bad except one. Asa wasn't too bad, but the rest of them were rotters. And we invited each other last week to play a game of top trumps to see whether you could score highest for how evil that they were. Well, this week we meet somebody that if you had the Ahab card, it is the top trump. He is the worst. Look at verse 30 again, chapter 16, verse 30. Ahab, son of Omri, did evil in the sight of the Lord more than all who were before him. It's quite an accolade, isn't it? Congratulations, Ahab. Nobody has ever done as much evil as you. You take first prize. Or look down at verse 33. Ahab made an Asherah. Ahab did more to provoke the Lord, the God of Israel, to anger than all the kings of Israel who were before him. Congratulations, Ahab. God has never been as angry with anybody as he is with you. The most evil king who makes God the most angry. And just a little aside there, notice that God's anger and evil go together. So God isn't angry just because he's grumpy. We'll read about God's anger in 1 Kings, but God isn't angry just because he's got a short fuse or because he's tired or because he gets out of bed the wrong side or because the traffic lights go red when he's a bit late or the sort of petty things that make us angry. God is angry because he loves what is good and he hates what's evil. And Ahab does things that are evil. And there is actually kind of rightness to it, isn't there? People sometimes talk about the angry God of the Old Testament, but actually you wouldn't want it to be otherwise, would you? You wouldn't want a God who could sit in heaven remote and look at evil and say, well, I'm not really fussed. It doesn't really get my heart beating one way or the other. And when you turn the pages of the Evening Standard and you read about the latest teenager stabbed on the streets of London, I think it's right that we feel a bit angry about that. Evil and anger, they're supposed to go together. This man is the most evil, and so God is the most angry. But what is it that makes God so angry with him? Just look at verse 31. As if it had been a light thing for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. Do you remember that was the king who built the alternative religion, the DIY religion? He made calves for people to worship, made them of gold so they looked kind of glorious and religious. He consecrated his own priests, he made up his own festivals, and he made up another religion, and it took people away from God. And so every time Jeroboam's mentioned, except this one, he's called Jeroboam the son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin. He was a king who led other people away from God. And Ahab does that, but with bells on. He took for his wife Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, and served Baal, and built an altar for Baal in the house of Baal, which he built in Samaria. Four mentions of Baal. Baal was a local Canaanite deity, and he looks a bit like this. I've got a slide. This is it's now in the Louvre in Paris. It wasn't originally in Paris, but they nabbed it before the British Museum did. But you can see it in Paris. And this is a stela of Baal that was excavated in a city called Ugarit, up towards the north of Israel. And along with it, there was loads of writing that was in an alphabet that nobody could understand. And then somebody figured out, actually, it was a guy who, in the Second World War, had been involved in code breaking and cryptography. After the war, was looking for a new career and realized he was quite good at decoding strange ancient Near Eastern alphabets. So he began to put together Ugaritic alphabet. We can now read all kinds of things in ancient Ugaritic, including loads of stuff about Baal. And one of the great things we learn about Baal, this fake god, was that he was a storm god. He was the god of the the skies and the clouds. He was the God of lightning bolts and the God of wind and rain. And so you pray to Baal if you want to be sinful, as in fact we've had this last weekend, maybe after long weeks of an English unusual summer. The Baal worshippers would get together saying it's time to pray to Baal because we need it to rain. And then you'll see he's holding there in his hand a spear. It's a spear at the bottom, and it's a little staff at the, it's a little plant at the top. And this is what the curator of the Louvre says on their website about this. The beautiful visual metaphor of the spear transformed into a plant is an allusion to the beneficial effects of the rain produced by storms. There we are. So he makes it rain, and then things flourish and grow, and Greenwich Park looks green again instead of looking pallid and yellow, and everything grows. So can you think of a deliciously ironic way in which the true God, the one true and living God, could show that Baal is a complete fake? What would be the best way to do that? Well, how about chapter 17, verse 1? Elijah, the Tishbite of Tishbe in Gilead, said to Ahab, "As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives." By the way, it's a little pointed thing there, isn't it? Just to remind you, Baal is not the God of Israel. And as the king of Israel, you've got no place worshipping Baal. Yahweh, the Lord, he's the God of Israel. And as he lives, I tell you, there's not going to be any rain, no dew or rain these years, except by my word. In other words, God says, oh, you're a weather god, are you? Fair enough. Let's have a weather competition. Let's have a rain competition. I say it's not going to rain. Over to you, Baal. Let's see whether you can bring the fertility and the crops that you promised. It's kind of ironic, isn't it? The punishment fits the crime. Ahab worships a storm god, so God announces a drought. Notice, though, that the judgment, as often in the Bible, it's announced before it's experienced. I mean, I could try it, and I could really impress you with my powers as a prophet, okay? I announce to you that it's not going to rain unless I say so. Look out the window. It's totally dry. Are you impressed? Well, not really. I mean, anyone can wait for a dry day and then prophetically announce that it's going to be dry, okay? That this kind of announcement only becomes impressive after a month of dryness, or after 3 months of no rain, or after we go through the rainy season and it doesn't rain, or after we get into the third year of rainy seasons and it still doesn't rain. Then you start to think, you know, his words are quite powerful. Just at the beginning, it's just an announcement. I mean, anyone can make an announcement about judgment. What if they're just bluffing? And of course, the Bible makes announcements about judgment, doesn't it? It says God is angry because of evil. And he set a day on which he'll judge the world, says the Apostle Paul. Well, anyone can say that. Where is it? It's been 2,000 years. No sign of thunderbolts from heaven striking down those who worship other gods. Seems that God doesn't mind. Seems that judgment is just an empty promise. You see, a word of judgment, how seriously should we take it? If God will actually start to, you know, torch things from fire from heaven, you take that pretty seriously, but just the threat of it, what if he's bluffing? And it's like the narrator knows that we're going to struggle with that, and so just before this word of judgment, we're given a little reminder about the power of God's words. Just look at the end of chapter 16. Here's a tragedy. In the days of Ahab, a man called Hiel of Bethel decided to rebuild the ancient city of Jericho. It had been destroyed for many, many years, and he decided to rebuild the ruins. But it's a tragedy because it cost him two of his own children in the building project. At the foundation of the city, somehow, we're not told exactly how, but his firstborn, Abiram, died. A rock fell on him, or some kind of mining accident as they were quarrying for the stone they needed. Who knows? And as they're completing the city and setting up the gates, his youngest son, Segub, dies. And what a tragedy in a family to lose your oldest and your youngest in this building project. But of course, we shouldn't be surprised, because it's exactly what God had said through Joshua, son of Nun. If you just open your little service sheet, you'll find I've laid it out on a table for you. And 1 Kings on the left and Joshua on the right. Joshua, at least 400 years previously. So a word of God that was made, you know, everyone's forgotten it now. God said this would happen. It just seems an irrelevance. Century after century after century passes. And then along comes this guy and decides to rebuild Jericho. But Joshua had said, "Cursed before the Lord is the man who rebuilds the city Jericho." Joshua had said, "At the cost of his firstborn shall he lay its foundation." And indeed, he laid its foundation at the cost of Abiram, his firstborn. And Joshua said, "At the cost of his youngest shall he set up its gates." And surely enough, he set up its gates at the cost of his youngest. You see, it's not just that it comes true in a kind of vague Nostradamus kind of way. You know, people get excited because if you interpret the words vaguely enough, you can persuade yourself that Nostradamus got everything right about world history. It's not vague or horoscopy. It's extremely specific. Your firstborn when you lay the foundation, your youngest when you set up the gates, and it comes true exactly. The author's just reminding you, when God says something, when God announces judgment, you can be sure that it will happen. And so God says to the storm god, Baal, "No rain except by my word." And sure enough, as weeks turn into months, turn into years, things get pretty desperate. So Elijah sensibly goes and camps out next to a brook. If there's going to be a drought, you want to be near a river, a water supply. But by verse 7, the brook's dried up. So the riverbeds start to run dry. Then we meet this woman in Zarephath. And it's not that she's depressed when she says, "Oh, I was just going to go and get a couple of sticks and make a fire and then we're going to eat it and die." It's not a suicide pact. She just means there is literally no food left. And I kept till last this little handful of flour and a few drops of oil to make our last chapata. And then we'll eat that roasted over two sticks, because there's not really any wood to speak of either. And that'll be our last meal. Because there is a severe, severe famine in the land. The beginning of chapter 18, we'll look at it next time, we see the king, Ahab himself, touring the entire country just to try and find some grass so that he can feed them to the royal cattle, so that all the animals won't die. I mean, it's a pathetic picture to have to search the height and breadth of the land just to find any grass that hasn't withered up. It is a severe, severe famine. God warned, actually long before, that if God's people were to turn away from him, and if they were to go after other gods, he warned them. This is back in the book of Deuteronomy we looked at on our weekend away. He says, "The anger of the Lord will be kindled against you, and he will shut up the heavens so that there will be no rain." And sure enough, there's no rain. In fact, you might remember when we were looking at the prayer that when Solomon dedicated the temple earlier in 1 Kings, and Solomon's envisaging all of these terrible scenarios where they might need to pray to God for his mercy. And one of them was the same thing. "Lord, if you shut up the heavens so that there is no rain because they sinned against you, and please, if they turn to you and pray, will you forgive their sin and grant rain?" And famine, drought, it's a desperate, desperate thing. It is God's judgment on a people, ironically, who've abandoned the true God and worshipped a God of rain. Really? Baal can't help you now. And Baal with his stick, with the spear flourishing into a lovely plant. Seems quite empty now, doesn't it? Your engravings and your carvings. He can't help you now. God's judgment is a terrible thing. But in the midst of judgment, and we're going to see this again and again through this whole series, that the backdrop is going to be evil kings, God being rightly angry and judgment. That's pretty much the backdrop for the whole of 1 and 2 Kings, with a few exceptions. But against that backdrop, we discover that God is very kind and very merciful and very gracious, even when he's supposed to be very angry. And in the midst of this drought, God protects his prophet Elijah. He protects him, first of all, by advising the campsite down by the river, Elijah, you're going to need some water. Go by the brook Kishon, and I'm going to send the birds to feed you. Yes, birds are good at pecking out the last little bits of food. They can get an aerial view of the whole land. And he just waits there, and the ravens come, and they bring him all the food he needs. They bring him bread and meat, even. This is pretty cool. No Ocado order. It just comes from the sky. But then the brook dries up. He's got to move on. And then instead of a raven, we have a widow. I've commanded a widow there to feed you, which amazingly she does, even though she's got pretty much zero food. She's got one handful of flour left. Elijah, quite cheekily, in my opinion, says, well, give me that first, and then what's left over you can make for you and your son. I mean, it's a bit insensitive. This is her last meal. Yeah, just hand it over. Because he knows that God is going to miraculously multiply this bread, this flour, and this oil. So this is like a sort of ancient, several centuries BC, bottomless refill kind of concept. Except it's not that you have to take it to the Coca-Cola fountain, you need to get more syrup mixed with soda water. You just scoop it out, and it fills up again. It's pretty cool, isn't it? So, and she does this for months and months and months. And she's making chapatis, I guess, because that's what you make out of bread and oil roasted on fire. And she's making a lot of chapatis. And it doesn't matter how many you make, there's still enough bread and oil in the chapatis. How do you know that? Because God says so. And things that God says come true. It's beautiful, actually, isn't it? It's not just in judgment. Cursed before the Lord be the man who rises up and rebuilds Jericho. At the cost of his firstborn shall he lay its foundation. At the cost of his younger shall he set up its gates. He laid its foundations at the cost of his firstborn. He set up his gates at the cost of his youngest. God says it, and it happens exactly the same. But look down at verse 14. God says it, the jar of oil, the flour shall not be spent, the jar of oil shall be empty. Look down at verse 16. The jar of flour was not spent, neither did the jug of oil become empty, according to the word of the Lord that he spoke by Elijah. He spoke by Joshua, and there's judgment on Jericho. He speaks by Elijah, and there's food in the cupboard. God's word sets the agenda. It brings judgment, and it brings mercy. And you kind of expect, wouldn't you, God to preserve his faithful prophet in days of judgment. I mean, Elijah, after all, is the faithful, loyal spokesman of God. So he doesn't deserve to be cursed by drought. He gets spared. But this is where the story gets really exciting, and it builds to a climax. Because God doesn't just save Elijah, he saves two other people in this story. Namely, the widow and her son. In fact, they get saved arguably twice, I think. So they're about to die because they have no food. And God provides food and they're saved from death. And then the son does die of an illness. And then the Lord grants him life again. He's resurrected from the dead. So you might say he's sort of saved from death twice. But the second one's even more dramatic and miraculous than the first. And this woman, because of what happens, comes to trust in God for herself. Did you notice? She begins by saying, she refers to Elijah, the Lord, your God, verse 12, as the Lord, your God lives. In other words, not really my God, but your God. But by the end of the chapter, she confesses her trust in him. Now I know that you are a man of God, the true God, and that the word of the Lord in your mouth is truth. God shows mercy to this woman, but there's a fact about her that you almost don't spot. At least I missed it to start with, and I think it is very, very significant. And this woman is from Zarephath. Now you're thinking, come on, Andrew, my Bible geography is not that good. What is so significant about Zarephath? And actually, the author isn't expecting us to have a brilliant Bible geography because he tells us what's important about Zarephath. Verse 9. Zarephath is important because Zarephath is in Sidon. Get it? You're thinking, no, Andrew, I still don't get it. I mean, what is so significant about Sidon? Well, we're told something about Sidon just at the end of chapter 16. The author tells everything we need, actually, if we just listen out. Verse 31. What was so evil about King Ahab? What made God so angry about King Ahab? Instead of following the true God, the God of Israel, he went off to get a wife from Sidon and started worshipping her gods instead. It's a pattern we've seen before with Solomon. Remember all of his foreign wives? 700 of them, pretty crazy. He went with marrying pagans. But he built shrines to each of his pagan wives, and his heart turned away. It's the same thing again. History repeats itself. Ahab goes to Sidon. Sidon is the home of Baal worship. It's where pagans make engravings of gods who they think can send the rain and the wind. And they worship Baal, and they make Asherahs. Asherahs, by the way, are sort of slightly naughty-shaped phallic symbols. They basically look like penises, and they're the stone ones, and they're all over the ancient Near East. So you go to an archaeology site in a very sort of genteel Christian archaeological tour, and everyone's trying to turn away and pretend they don't notice the obvious symbolism in the shape. It's basically a fertility cult. We're worshipping this phallic symbol, and we're worshipping this rain god in Sidon. And this woman is from Zarephath, and that's in Sidon. In other words, she doesn't know the tree god. She doesn't worship the tree god. She worships Baal and Asherah. She worships the fake god, that god that the tree god hates. And yet she is saved and fed. And even she gets one of the most extraordinary miracles in the whole of the Old Testament. Her son gets brought back to life. Now, sometimes there are resurrections of sort of that are enormously significant in the Bible, and they're very key people who get resurrected. But this guy's, and we never meet him again, he's not important for the rest of the story, and he doesn't go on to do anything particularly significant. It seems that it's almost like a gratuitous miracle, just because God was very kind to a widow who lost her son in a time of desperation. That's all. God is very, very, very generous to her as a pagan worshipper. And you put the whole chapter together and you discover that God is angry with the people that you assumed he would like, and God is kind to the people with whom you assumed he'd be angry. Let's line them up. Ahab. Ahab is the king of the people of God, the king of Israel. He's got a Bible, well, at least the first part of the Bible, and all of God's laws and all of God's ways. And he does nothing with that knowledge. In fact, he turns away from it. He sets up another religion, and he makes God very, very angry. Here's a woman who's a no-hoper. She's from far away, has no access to the truth, worships her pagan practices, which God despises. And then just by chance one day, she's told, or she just knows she's supposed to, feed this traveling prophet with her last meal, and she does it. Quite a good decision, as it turns out, because then it turns out to get a bottomless flour jug out of it. And she carries on doing so, but then her son dies, and it's almost like she's learned enough about the true God to sort of have a theology of why she might deserve to suffer. An awful thing. She doesn't quite understand it, but she says to Elijah, you know, is this because of my sin? Is this some sort of vindictive just desserts? I know I haven't been the best. I know I've made mistakes. Is that why my son had to die? She's bitter about it, but she kind of knows she's not been innocent before God. But God's merciful, and she receives her son back, and she says, now I know that you are a prophet of the true God, and his words are true. Well, in our reading, our other reading rather, Jesus had something to say about this. Luke chapter 4, let me find it again. I tell you the truth, Jesus says, there were many widows in Israel in the days of Elijah, when the heavens were shut up 3 years and 6 months and a great famine came over the land. And Elijah was sent to none of them, but only to Zarephath in the land of Sidon, to a woman who was a widow. That's the point of this story. God is angry at evil. God is angry at evil of people who are supposed to be his people. I guess there'll be some surprises on the judgment day. And people who are supposed to be bishops and archbishops and professors of theology and leaders of churches and attenders of churches, who it turned out didn't honour the true God and in their hearts crowded them full of all sorts of other idols that they trusted in. And God's very, very upset about that. And then there were the surprises the other way, of the people that you never would have dreamt would have had anything to do with Christianity. And maybe some of the radical Islamists in London. Someone plotting a terrorist attack, maybe, who comes under the sound of the gospel and begins to trust it and finds God to be extraordinarily merciful. Maybe someone at the head of Stonewall or a gay activist group. You think they'd never want anything to do with the teaching of the Bible that they have vilified as being so homophobic. And then they hear the gospel and they encounter the welcome of true Christians for anybody from any background. They begin to discover God's mercy and they come in. I hope you're ready for surprises. God's angry with the hypocrite, the king of Israel, but God is merciful to the outsider and the pagan. It's why Jesus reserved his most stinging words for the religious authorities and was the most tender to the prostitute or the tax collector, the no-hoper. There were many widows in the land of Israel, says Jesus. But Elijah was sent to none of them, but to Zarephath in the land of Sidon, in the land of Baal. And you might say at the end of round one, the rain competition, it's 1-0. Well, Baal has a chance in round two. We'll see next week if you can come back and see if he fares any better then. We're going to take a pause, a chance to just reflect quietly, and then Claire's going to come and lead us in prayer.